All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And now we're going to continue on, I think, a little bit with one of those themes we were discussing with Lou Rockwell just now. With our next guest, Gary Chartier. From Riverside, California, he's an associate professor of law and business ethics at La Sierra University and calls himself a left-wing market anarchist. His blog is at liberallaw.blogspot.com, and his book is called The Conscience of an Anarchist. Welcome to the show, Gary. How are you doing?
Great, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very happy to talk to you. So, libertarianism is the rich white man's anarchy. If you're for market anarchy, then you think that all poor and disadvantaged people should die in the streets, and how come you hate everybody so much? Why are you so far to the right of Dick Cheney?
Yeah, that is a familiar story. It's definitely a piece of rhetoric we hear all the time. And I guess what I and some of my friends at the Center for a Stateless Society keep trying to emphasize is that the state is not the source of protection for vulnerable people against economic elites. The state is the principal tool of economic elites that's used to extract wealth from ordinary people and redistribute it upward.
Okay, but, well, forget the ordinary people, because the politicians always say middle class this and middle class that. What about people who are barely making it at all or aren't making it at all?
Well, the state does a hell of a lot to make and keep them poor. It denies them opportunities to start small businesses. It denies them opportunities to seek alternatives to low-wage employment by raising the cost of starting businesses, raising the cost of maintaining them through business license fees, through occupational licensure, and a whole range of other things that definitely don't work to their advantage.
So now you and Roderick Long and my next guest, actually Sheldon Richman, you guys don't like the word capitalism, and you don't like the idea that as people try to spin it all the time, of course, that libertarianism is a right-wing conservative phenomenon at all. And in fact, you guys really kind of fight with the more right-wing libertarians sometimes, no?
Yeah, that is sometimes true. I mean, I don't want to get sidetracked, I guess, via a conversation about the meaning of the word capitalism, but I do really think that the history shows that the state is the ally of the corporate elite, and it's definitely not the friend of those who are trying to escape from economic pressure. Rather, it's really a source of problems both for middle class and for working class and poor people. And we'd like to highlight that. We frankly think that the rhetoric that's used very often to defend free markets it tends to turn very often into rhetoric that's really defending the corporate status quo, and we'd like to challenge that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brian Doherty's book on the history of libertarianism was called Radicals for Capitalism, Not Conservatives for Getting High.
Absolutely. It's a great book.
But that part of it tells a lot of the story, and, of course, I always do promote because, of course, it's anti-war radio, so a lot of my audience is, more left-leaning. And so I always try to recommend Rothbard's essay from, 1965 or something, Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty, where he defines libertarianism as all the way to the left. That's where individualist anarchy and property rights and pure enlightenmentism in practice exists, and that to him, any move towards socialism or what we now call just regular liberalism in America is really moving to the right. That's conservatism. That's, the middle of the road to fascism.
Absolutely. I think the message has to get out repeatedly that while people on the statist left may genuinely think, I don't want to pretend to gauge their motives, that they're sticking up for the interests of middle class and working class and poor people, very often what they're doing is playing into the hands of those who want to use the state to redistribute wealth upward through privilege and that statist left movement is in a kind of unfortunate, awkward middle ground where it's using very often the rhetoric of freedom, but using that rhetoric to support moves that are very much opposed to the underlying goals that it claims to endorse.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you know, I can only play devil's advocate so well because I'm not a liberal, you know, modern day definition of a liberal, but I think probably they would say that the natural state of capitalism in a laissez-faire system is that wealth is transferred up and up and up, and if you don't use the government to, you know, progressive taxation, et cetera, to force some of that money to redistribute it down, you know, demand-side economics and all that, Barack Obama's going to take good care of you kind of economics, that the only other alternative to that is this ridiculous trickle-down theory, where if only the billionaires or even richer billionaires, then finally maybe we'll get a raise someday or something like that. Now, you don't believe that, do you?
No, I sure don't. I think, in fact, the evidence is that the billionaires are precisely the folks who need very often the help of the government. If we look at the history of American political economy during the past, say, 120 years, what we see is that competition at the end of the 19th century was dramatically undermining profit margins. Competition was intense and stiff, and it wasn't enabling the wealthy and well-connected to do better and better. So what did they do? They went to the government to demand assistance in promoting what were, in fact, deliberately anti-competitive measures that safeguard their profits and therefore screwed consumers. The consumer is not waiting for, it shouldn't be waiting for the assistance of the corporate state to assist them. The evidence from American history is the corporate state is precisely there to screw the consumer, to redistribute wealth into the pockets of the well-connected.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think that the Constitution was a right-wing fascist counter-revolution backlash, you know, this reactionary effort. They used the Shays Rebellion, which was their 9/11 excuse of the day to ram through their Patriot Act.
And absolutely.
To empower basically the people who were already the richest at the expense of everybody else.
Completely agree.
And, you know, it's hard to swallow that kind of thing when you're new to it. Because I remember, you know, it was hard for me. I had to... I was a Cold War revisionist, and then I was a World War I revisionist. It was really hard for me to get over my indoctrination into the glories of World War II, and pretty hard, well, not quite as hard, but still pretty hard for me to get over all my indoctrination of the glories of the Civil War II and the greatness of all this nationalism. I mean, after all, I mean, the way, roughly paraphrasing my seventh grade teacher, it's a democracy, and the people have decided along the way that, you know, these other ways of doing it didn't work, and so they made it this way on purpose. So what do you have to complain about? Nobody's really smarter than the collective wisdom of all these people and their votes over all these years. This is the way it's supposed to be, Gary.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that story for a long time, Scott. I guess I just think the evidence suggests, and the arguments show, that when theoretically democratic political structures are employed to make decisions, their primary purpose is to mask the fact that to give legitimacy to the mischief of the elite. And so what we notice in American politics is we have putatively democratic elections and the people supposed to decide, and what happens instead is that we shift between various factions of the war party, various factions of the economic elite. One takes over, the public gets tired of that. If the public were to really start to notice what was going on, that might create some legitimacy problems for the establishment. So what happens, of course, is we shift in somebody from the other faction. And Tweedledum and Tweedledee just keep their ridiculous stance going.
Well, and it really is like Robert Higgs' ratchet effect, too, where even when somebody's elected to come in specifically, the mandate is to undo what the last guy did. They never do.
Absolutely not. I mean, you know.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to hold it right there, Gary, and take this break. But we'll be right back with Gary Chartier. He's a professor in Southern California, and he's the author of the book Conscience of an Anarchist. Ha! I'm sorry, I almost called you conservative there. That would have been horrible.
No worries.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Gary Chartier, author of Conscience of an Anarchist, and self-described left libertarian market anarchist. But so, what defines the left is opposition to property rights. I forget where what we were talking about before the break, so I'm picking up here. Property is theft. You're keeping things from everyone else. You're the aggressor, not me trying to take it from you. How do you like that?
Well, you know, I think that all that's just a piece of silly rhetoric. Finally, I think that property rights can be tremendous sources of empowerment for those who have them and for those who trade with those who have them. The question is, are they fundamentally just? Are the acquisitions people engage in fundamentally just? We're looking at a society right now in which tremendous quantities of property are in people's hands because of transfers by the state from everything from eminent domain to encroachment in colonial era times have resulted in their transfer to well-connected elites. You know, we think about the fact, for instance, that the Continental Congress simply handed George Washington a couple of 100,000 acres after the Revolutionary War, simply drew lines on a map and said, "General, this is yours." The official story was that most of this was supposed to go to soldiers in the Revolutionary Army, but in fact, 80,000 of those acres, I believe, went straight to Washington himself, and most of the others were handed out to people who were his cronies, people who had been on his staff during the war and so forth. So it's easy when you look at the distribution of property that results from that kind of development to think, wow, the problem is property. But no, the problem is the political distribution of property to well-connected elites. Similarly, think about the way in which the military-industrial complex siphons tax money from ordinary people's pockets into those companies that are responsible for death and destruction around the world and at the same time for fattening the wallets of the most well-connected, industry probably in the country. So, it's not property that's the issue here. The issue here is how force is used to redistribute wealth upward. So property rights then, if they're understood uncritically, might be seen as somehow, safeguarding the results of that, that maldistribution. But in fact, a reasonable property rights system is going to see those people, as thieves, and see them, in fact, as agents of the state, not as people a just property rights system ought to protect. Mm.
Well, you know, in a way, it's, and I guess this is why you and I are both anarchists, to have a state at all, basically, is communism, from each according to his ability to each according to his security needs. At the absolute minimum, you know, supposedly they claim a monopoly on the right to be the security force, and all those rich white property owners all have the benefit of forcing poor people to pay for their security guards all day long. I mean, an actual communist has a good point complaining about that, doesn't he? That
Absolutely.
These people don't have to secure their own property. They could be an absentee landlord for decades, and the local sheriff will keep squatters off.
Right. And this is the story not just of individual property owners. It's the story of the U.S. empire, you know, which very often serves to shift the cost of, opening up markets, dealing with piracy, whatever, from business owners onto the American taxpayer. You know, Theodore Roosevelt, a great progressive hero, turns out to be a guy who really saw opportunities for military action under every Bush and very much was interested in using the U.S. military to open up a world for American dominance that clearly was going to be very beneficial to the well-connected businesses of his day.
Yeah.
And that's a story that gets played out today, obviously, in the world of Halliburton and Blackwater making bucket loads of money on Iraq. It's the story of Barack Obama enthusiastically continuing the imperialism of his predecessors and in so doing providing a range of benefits to well-connected American businesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, you know, speaking of Theodore Roosevelt, of course, that was the subject of Barack Obama's speech last week where he went through the litany. We've all
right.
heard a million times about how laissez-faire causes all problems and government is the solution to them all. And, of course, he's invoking Theodore Roosevelt the whole time. And talking about busting trust, which is pretty funny coming from Barack Obama. But anyway, I'm trying to think of, like, the most credible point he made probably was about education and how, you know, it used to be only very rich people could afford education and, you know, higher education. And now you could really be the son or daughter of a couple of people in a real bad situation who have no means whatsoever, and the government can help you go even to grad school and get an advanced specialized degree and advance your own life into six-digit incomes and the advancement of all mankind with the great research you're doing. And government is giving that helping hand. And Gary would prefer we live in a world where only born millionaires get to go to college.
Well, you know, the story here is complicated, but one thing I'd say is that the involvement of the government in the higher education business, and this is something that I obviously as a professor benefit from to one degree or another, but the presence of government funds here is not obviously improving the well-being of ordinary people so much as it is shifting money into the higher education industry and, frankly, making it easier for credentialism to be an inescapable feature of our lives, so that somebody with less education has fewer job opportunities now than he or she once had. With the presence of government money in the education industry, expectations regarding credentials go up, the cost of higher education goes up, really there are some perverse effects here such that the people's opportunities are limited as a result of this this government involvement in higher education, without self-evidently dramatically improving everybody's life. So I'm not convinced that the optimistic story there is one that that I need to buy into. The fact is, people who are qualified and are going to be able to make use of their skills in productive ways would be able, in the state's absence, to get access to loans just as they do now. But the difference is that you wouldn't have vast subsidies for a lot of unproductive higher educational activity, and you wouldn't have subsidies that drove up expectations of people's credentials and so forth in ways that limited access to employment rather than expanding it.
Hey, and maybe we wouldn't even have the complete militarization of all scientific research in our society at that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what so much federal money has served to do, to co-opt researchers into the military-industrial complex. And again, I just have to keep beating on that drum. It's Obama. It's not just the Republicans.
Right. All right. It's Gary Chartier. Liberallaw.blogspot.com is his blog. And The Conscience of an Anarchist is his book. You can buy it everywhere. Thank you so much for your time, Gary. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.